This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and acknowledge their ongoing connection to land, waters and culture. Genocide and colonization are ongoing processes that continue to this day. Sovereignty was never ceded, this always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hey, and welcome back to Auspulse Snackpod, the weekly podcast where we bring you bite-sized chunks of Australian politics and news with a side of crispy memes. I'm Noon, and that's my co-host, Zach.
Hey, what's up?
And we are Australia's foremost political nobodies, and we are also the official podcast of the Auspulse Shitposting Facebook group, which is currently called ACAB Shitposting. And we're also trying to rejig our introduction to this show a little bit. So
yeah. We've got we've got a lot of titles. We've got a lot of honorifics now. There's a lot of things we have to introduce ourselves as. We'll streamline.
We'll sort it
eventually.
Out.
Yeah. But for the moment, we're taking a maximalist approach.
Just tell them everything. Yeah.
Sort of
a Daenerys, you know, breaker of chains, mother of dragons, Australia's foremost political nobodies.
Maybe we need someone else to come and hype us up.
A hype man.
I just rewatched A Knight's Tale like a week or two ago, which was honestly more entertaining than I thought it would be. I forgot that Geoffrey Chaucer is a character in that movie, and there's a bunch of scenes where Chaucer just like talks a bunch of shit and introduces his ledger, and maybe we need that guy.
Yeah.
Is Chaucer available? Do you know?
I mean, all we need is a time machine, right? That's what happens in A Knight's Tale, isn't it? Is a time machine or magic? I don't know. I haven't seen it.
No, that's very funny, though. They just, it's all set in the Middle Ages. It's just that the soundtrack has Queen on it.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's enough introduction, I think. Why don't we move straight on into our entree? Oh, well, the last couple of weeks, I guess I should preface by saying we've had kind of some unusual episodes. We had our 1 year and then our sort of proper 1 year, and there was the BLM episode. So there's been a bunch of news that we've kind of missed out on over the last few weeks that's been piling up. So we're going to try and get through a bunch of that today. So for entrees, I wanted to talk about the government's response to the economic crisis of coronavirus and especially how gendered that response is. And I kind of wanted to say off top that basically none of the sources that I found for this mentioned trans people or gender non-conforming people. So to listeners, I'm sorry about that. This is ironically going to be a heavily gendered story, talking about men and women. So anyway, I just thought I'd mention that up top. So basically the government's response to coronavirus has been extremely gendered, and I think is going to really significantly reduce the number of women and the proportion of women in the workforce and increase the number of women who are staying at home doing unpaid childcare and unpaid domestic labor. And the government's actions seem to be specifically designed to force women to do that. And I love conspiracy theories, but I try not to be an actual conspiracy theorist. I think that probably normally the government doesn't sit down and be like, how can we be as shitty as possible? I think they have their own ideological commitments that lead to that. But in this case, I feel like the responses have been so specifically anti-woman that I think there must have been a conversation at some point where someone was like, well, what if we fix the economy by making women take on all of this unpaid labor that they used to do, just like God intended. So anyway, with that cynical...
Would have gone down a treat with our Prime Minister.
Yeah, exactly. I could easily believe him being like, yeah, it would be good if women stayed home and cared for their children. Then the economy would be fine.
Fighting on the home front, yeah. Just like it used to be.
Yeah. So women have already been affected harder than men by the economic downturn, with the hardest hit sectors being ones with very high proportions of women, so mainly retail and hospitality. But another really big issue has been about childcare. And so as we discussed a couple of episodes ago in episode 49, there was this early childhood education and care package, the ECEC package, which the government produced. And it was basically free childcare for everyone in Australia, and early childhood education. And the idea was basically to keep the early childhood centres and education centres open and not charging fees for essential workers, right? So if there were nurses who still needed to, or doctors or whatever, who needed their kids to be looked after that, that would all be happening, and that the childcare industry wouldn't collapse in the middle of a time where we needed people working. Mm. And early childhood is an extremely gendered article, and according to one article by Angela Priestley from 2019...
Extremely gendered industry? Sector?
Sector, yeah.
Yeah, you said article.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was skimming ahead in the notes. Yeah, it's an extremely gendered industry. And according to one article by Angela Priestley from 2019, 97% of childcare and early childhood education workers are women.
Mm.
97% is ridiculous. And it's also a very low-paid industry, which is probably just a coincidence, right?
Yeah. I was about to say, oh, yeah. So, yeah, go on. Beat me to it.
The average hourly wage is less than half of the Australian average in childcare and early childhood education.
That is just so fucked.
Yeah. And so the news about this is that the government is stopping these subsidies. So they're stopping the childcare subsidies. So families will go back to paying fees as normal. And they're justifying this by saying that attendance to childcare is back up to just under 75% of pre-coronavirus levels. But look, I'm not an economist, Zach. I'm not a reporter. I'm not an economist. I'm not a lot of things. But as far as I can tell, 75% of business returns means that 25% of businesses will close, right? That seems like supply and demand. And, like, obviously that's going to depend on how those childcare centers are, like, geographically distributed or whatever. But there's a lot of anecdotal evidence as well that people are planning on withdrawing their children from childcare when the subsidies end. So it's likely to be actually significantly more than 25% of businesses closing.
Great.
And, of course, what happens when the children aren't at kindy or creche, like what happens when they're withdrawn from childcare, is that in the vast majority of cases, their mothers or other women in the family, aunts and whatever, will be caring for the children at home, right? So this policy, which appears to be about a sector kind of getting back on its feet or whatever, the policy that they're doing is going to hurt female-dominated industry, and the way that it's going to hurt that industry is also going to affect women disproportionately. But it's worse than that, because the government is also cutting JobKeeper for the entire childcare sector well in advance of the rest of JobKeeper. So,
yeah, because 75% of kids are going back, so
they can make 75%. I guess they don't need to pay their employees anymore.
Yeah, those employees can now get paid 75% of their already extremely low wages.
That's right, yeah.
It's just, yeah. It's a win-win.
And so, yeah, all of JobKeeper is currently scheduled to end at the end of September, but childcare is ending in the middle of July, so more than 2 months before the rest of the economy. And there's literally no reason or explanation for this whatsoever, right? Like, as you said, it's like, oh, 75%, blah, blah, blah. But, like, that's roughly true of the rest of the economy, too. And, again, it seems like this is a policy that has been carefully designed to make women do unpaid domestic labor instead of paid caring labor in the workforce. So
that's how you balance the books, my friend.
Yeah, that's what's being cut. But right, so that's one part of the like government response that I wanted to touch on. And the other part is what's being funded, right? And this is a scheme called Home Builder, which, as I said, we wanted to talk about this over the last couple of weeks, but there's been more important stuff to do. So probably most of it already know. But there's a 25,000...
Such as Scott Morrison getting yelled at this press conference where he announced Home Builder.
Yes, that's
much
right.
Much more important for us to talk about than the policy itself.
Unironically, yes. But yeah, so this is a $25,000 handout for very, very, very specific home renovations. And it actually reminds me of Tony Abbott's Tools for Tradies scheme, if anyone remembers that. But that was much better because
vividly. Yeah, yeah.
I got fired
down
during that, which was a funny story. But anyway.
I don't know who doesn't remember Tools for Tradies. I talk about it all the time.
Yeah, well, like, it was one of the least bad things that Tony Abbott did, because it was, like, an actual useful stimulus going to small business. But this one that Scott Morrison has done is basically going directly to retirees who want a new veranda. Like, we don't have time to get into the details about the, like, restrictions on Home Builder, but basically no one who needs it will get it, and everyone who will get it could afford it anyway. And so...
Yeah, it's like a criteria of getting it, is that you could basically already afford the
renovation. Yeah, that's literally like one of the requirements, yeah. And of course, the construction industry, which most of this money is going to then flow on to, is extremely male-dominated. And in a 2019 article from DiversityQ, they claimed that 99% of on-site construction jobs and 75% of the construction industry overall is men. So this stimulus is going almost directly to men, while the childcare sector and other like female-dominated sectors are being cut and deliberately undermined. So I'm nearly done. There's just one other thing, which is kind of a new story that's like not necessarily connected to the others, but it also has a gendered element that I kind of wanted to draw a connection with. And this is about uni fees. So this has just been announced in the last couple of days. But the government is aiming to have 100,000 extra uni students over the next decade. And Dan Tehan, the education minister, said that they're not going to be spending any extra. And like, get more students, but not more money? How does that work? And the answer is they're basically doubling uni fees for a lot of shit. They're doubling
humanities stuff.
Well, humanities, law, commerce, all going up. And things that are going down include like nursing, teaching, and maths, which I think is weird because like maths degrees tend to not have any employability at the other end. They're like pure research, but that's it's not very important. That's fine.
Yeah, but there's no emotion in maths, Noon.
That's right,
means that it's not a burger flipping degree like all these Western civilization degrees that we're also trying to get up.
Yep. Yeah, so they're disincentivizing a whole lot of these courses by making them more than twice as expensive, and they are making it cheaper to do nursing and teaching, which is good, but it's fucked that they're funding it by making other people spend more. And Dan Tehan is sort
of... Which is like, that's an absurd amount of money. Like, those degrees are already an absolutely wild amount of money that a number of people who do those courses would never be able to pay back over the course of a lifetime anyway.
Yeah.
But you're asking kids to take on 60K worth of debt, like, straight out of high school in order to study the arts? Like, that...
I heard some interview
That it wasn't already fucked before that.
Yeah.
So why not double fuck it? Yeah.
Someone was saying, like, arts degrees are really good because, like, if you don't know what you're doing, it's much cheaper to, like, do an arts degree and find a whole lot of stuff than, like, start a science degree, get a whole lot of hex debt, and realize partway through the third year that you don't want to do science. Like it's not actually... Yeah, anyway, whatever. So Tehan's saying it's not going to affect existing students, but it does mean that a lot of university places are going to be completely out of reach for like an entire new group of people who were previously able to access tertiary education. And so the higher fees are going to disproportionately affect women who are systemically paid less and discriminated against, as well as First Nations people and other groups that are being systemically discriminated against and who have lower average incomes in the Australian population. So... to wrap up the story, is our government a cabal of reactionary misogynists who are scheming to enforce a heteronormative nuclear family with one income and 2.5 children in a fiendish plot to make women take the fall for the economic fallout of the coronavirus pandemic? Yes.
You tell me.
Yeah, it's yes. The answer is yes.
Oh, it's a yes. Yes.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's also important to draw a line between the way that the government responded to the crisis and what they're now doing to universities, because obviously unis were fucked out of JobKeeper.
Yeah.
Because they exist in a sort of weird limbo between being public and private institutions. And now it's like, oh, your sector is dying? Oh, that's so sad. I guess we better come in and impose our own ideological framework, which involves undermining a whole bunch of what you stand for and your ability to operate in the first place.
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's a... as I think your as your broader point, as you've said, the kind of broad lesson to take from this is that the government's response throughout this entire crisis has been deeply ideological and will continue to be. And yeah, it's just kind of so cynical to take this opportunity to continue fucking over the people that they were already doing so.
Totally.
And, you know, bolstering the industries that they consider to be worthy because they build stuff or whatever.
There's been a bunch of good discussion about this in Auspol shitposting. So if you're interested in getting into arguments with me about whether or not degrees are a useful measure of education, feel free to hop on Facebook and find us at Auspol shitposting, currently ACAB shitposting.
For sure. Should we move on now to our First Nations stories, Noon?
Yep. So first I just wanted to touch on the story that we've been covering over the last few weeks about Rio Tinto and their destruction of the 45,000-year-old heritage sites at Juukan Gorge in the Pilbara. it's obviously been a really big story and something that I've been following really carefully. And so the news at the moment is that Rio has started an internal review on these explosions, and it's led by one of their board members, a guy called Michael Lestrange, who's a like spook spy guy slash diplomat who looks significantly less suave than his name. If you look at him, he's just like got these like giant ears and this like terrible comb over. Michael Lestrange. Anyway, so there's already a Senate inquiry, which was established last week, and that's going to finish up at the end of September, about a month before the Rio inquiry. And that's basically looking into like how the fuck Rio did this and like what the laws are that have led to this being a situation that comes across. But the CEO of Rio, Jean-Sébastien Jacques, said that they were going to fully cooperate with the Senate inquiry, which I can only assume means that they're going to have like five or six mid-rank people there to say, I don't know the answer to that question, for a couple of hours each. So, yeah.
Oh, and we work very closely with the PKKP people, and we are very sorry
also feel
for
their pain.
Misunderstanding the fact that they didn't want to have thousands of years of heritage blown up.
We thought that they said they did want thousands of years of heritage blown up, so...
Yeah, so we're sorry that a mistake happened.
But we are going to keep mining there, because it would be disrespectful to the damage that we've done to not then extract the iron ore.
We've already come this far.
Exactly.
I think we can all agree it would be ridiculous to stop now.
The Lestrange inquiry will look at Rio's heritage management processes and make recommendations to improve its internal governance, which presumably means, presumably they're not going to make the main recommendation that's actually going to help, which would be, like, liquidating the company, stop extracting shit from First Nations land, and, like, hand over the assets from their, like, colonial pillage to the people whose lands they've been pillaging. So, yeah, presumably that's not going to come across in the Rio inquiry.
We can bet that it's a pretty safe result. Yeah.
We have another First Nations story, though. Zach, do you want to take us through that?
Yeah, so this is another one that we've touched on before a little while ago now, but these are the law reforms to the people defaulting on fines in Western Australia. So in Western Australia, if you have outstanding fines and you can't pay them, you can go to jail in order to pay those fines off instead. I think
like each day has like a
it was like $250 a day or something like that. And obviously these were laws that disproportionately affected unemployed and disadvantaged people, but specifically Indigenous women. So these reforms are a response to the death of Miss Du, an Indigenous woman who died in police custody in 2014 after being imprisoned for unpaid fines. So the Western Australian government, the Labor government, promised in 2017 to reform these laws, and now they've finally just come into effect. So people who can't pay fines will now mostly have to do community service instead. And jail will now be a quote-unquote last resort.
Mm-hmm.
They can only be ordered by a magistrate. So people still can be locked up.
Yep.
And it's at the discretion of, the
court,
minister, whether or not
that
magistrate will happen.
Rather, sorry, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, magistrate. So I guess it's hard to say what it will actually look like in practice. I don't know what the conditions that need to be met are for jail to be a last resort.
Mm.
But, you know, I'm sure that if the police want to find a way to unnecessarily punish Indigenous women, they will continue to do that.
Totally.
But this is still, you know, it's a step forward. It should be abolished as a practice altogether, obviously, but we're probably not going to get there just yet. I have a quote here from the ABC article about this from Miss Du's uncle, Sean Harris. He said, "It's been a pretty exhausting and tiring, a long and needless fight." He said, "The unpaid fines law reform was worth celebrating, but it was too little too late for many families. There are so many people out there that have been locked up and incarcerated needlessly for unpaid fines," he said. "The people who struggle end up being in jail, and especially in recent years, we have seen a lot more Indigenous women being locked up for unpaid fines. Systemic racism still thrives in Western Australia." So it's obviously, you know, an inch being gained back against an absolutely unrelentingly brutal system. And, I think Ms. Du's family here are basically saying you need to take it where you can get it in terms of the victories, but we can't lose sight of the broader issues here. And so on that note, in Geraldton, There was a Black Lives Matter rally, Geraldton being in Western Australia. They had a Black Lives Matter rally the day after these reforms came into effect. And the Yamatji people from that area, as we've discussed previously on the show, have lost two women to police violence over the last year, Joyce Clark, who we've discussed, and Chedina Wynn, who we haven't. So that community is obviously still, you know, very, very raw about, you know, in regards to those incidents. And I just, to close this out, had a segment, had a quote from Mr.'s grandmother, Nana Carroll. And this is something that she said at the rally. She said, "Genocide has never left us. My ancestors went through it. I'm going through it. And now my kids are going through it. It's devastating. And with Black Lives Matter, I can hope something changes there. I really pray for that." Which kind of more broadly just leads to, I just wanted to briefly discuss the way that the media have been discussing Black Lives Matter protests over the last week or two, because as you say, we've been discussing other things. And just a lot of the coverage has been just so flagrantly biased against the protests, even, you know, and from our supposedly quote unquote progressive or like centrist media organizations like the ABC and the Age, etc. So obviously there was what something that we've discussed earlier, which was the Age's publishing of that article quoting an unnamed senior government source saying that protesters were planning to spit at cops. And then once that article was published, Daniel Andrews came out and said that no one should go to the protest and gave and the police an opportunity to be
do
like
whatever they want.
And since then, there have been a couple of COVID cases recorded from people who were at the Melbourne Black Lives Matter rally. So the headline will always read something along the lines of "Black Lives Matter protester among 8 new recorded cases of COVID in Victoria." But then if you scratch below the surface, oh, actually, this person couldn't have been infectious at the protest. They did attend, but they weren't infectious when they were there. Or this person...
And there's no evidence... Or they didn't catch it there and they didn't spread it to anyone there. They were there, or, though. Yeah.
And... Or in the case of another of these people, they were retested and tested negative later on, but the headline had already come and gone that, you know, they had tested positive and had been at the rally. So, yeah, I mean, that's just something that's been very frustrating in the media over the last few days that I wanted to point out before moving on.
Totally.
And yeah, just to round out, I guess, the Black Lives Matter and sort of a round of reporting here, we wanted to just bring in a little bit of Fasci Australia for you. Fasci Australia.
Refreshing.
Very, very refreshing. This week on Fasci Australia, we wanted to introduce you to a brand new special police unit.
Crack team.
Protection unit. Yeah, the crack team.
Law and order, SPU.
Making sure that the marble of our forefathers isn't cracked.
That's right. So this is about, like, obviously in the US and Britain, there's been a bunch of, like, statues pulled down and defaced and shit, which is fucking awesome. And in Australia, in Sydney, there was a police retinue of, like, seemingly at least 40 cops stationed overnight in Hyde Park in the middle of Sydney around the statue of Captain Cook, who was never a captain, incidentally, but that's fine. and to stop any of these protesters doing something unthinkable like graffitiing, which is obviously a much worse crime than colonial genocide. But they had, like, yeah, literally like 40 to 60 cops standing around this statue overnight. And then the next day, they left and it got defaced. Was it the next day it got defaced? Maybe the day after. But it was like very shortly afterwards. A Green staffer has been arrested and charged for defacing that property. Two Green staffers, I think. Well, two women, one of whom is
two
a green
women,
staffer.
One of whom is a Green staffer.
Yeah, yeah. Who works in David Shoebridge's office, and he has basically said, "Yeah, good on her," which is nice because, I don't know, there's a long history of the Greens like distancing themselves from activists in their party when the activists get in trouble for breaking the law. It's
yeah,
nice.
No, I was pleasantly surprised to see Shoebridge standing by his staffer, someone by the name of Jaron Shi, who, full disclosure, I went to primary school with.
Yeah.
And she was a badass then, and she's clearly a badass now, regardless of whatever did or didn't happen to a statue regarding a can of spray paint. But, I mean, it's still, like, it's been a rough one, obviously, for Giran, because she had the the Daily Telegraph, like, come to her home and photograph her on the street.
Fucking hell.
And, I mean, this is the kind of, like, fake sort of culture war bullshit that just, they absolutely love to run with the Murdoch press, but also politicians in general. And Shoebridge was censored by the New South Wales Parliament for this, for basically for not reprimanding or not firing Giran over this incident. So it just becomes this kind of stick to beat people with, but also it's like this opportunity to refocus the conversation away from the protests and onto the methods of protest try to make this argument as if it's all really about statues and it's all about symbols when, you know, like what people are saying when they deface statues is not, you know, it's not about the statue, obviously. It's part of a broader movement where, you know, trying to, like demanding and forcing change. About
colonialism.
Yeah. We understand our, like, national history and how, whether or not we acknowledge that we have a history of genocide and whether or not that's something that we should be celebrating. But it's much easier for the right to make it look in the media and in parliament as if this is an argument over public property or if it's about taking Chris Lilly's shows down from Netflix or banning episodes of Fawlty Towers.
When those
or
are really
or not
just like small pieces of people trying to like adjust the cultural landscape slightly in very small ways. And like taking Chris Lilly down from Netflix for a couple of months isn't going to like fix police violence, but it's like a tiny little step in the right direction. And it's the same with like defacing statues, right? It's about reorienting our public view of, as you said, our national history. And
but that's all that they will focus on. It doesn't go any further than that. It becomes, oh, it's just about political correctness, or it's just about shitting on Australian patriotism or whatever, when obviously it's much deeper than that, but they don't want to have that conversation. So I don't know. It's the chat about it in general, I found a little bit frustrating in that regard, but like, you know, props to the activists who are going out there and trying to get this shit done and trying to push the conversation, even if you're doing it in a landscape where almost every act of protest is going to be warped by the media and our politicians. Go on.
I was going to say, this is a bit of a side note, but something that I found particularly amusing about this whole thing was that someone on Auspol Shitposting pointed out that, like, if they wanted to stop the statues getting graffitied, they could probably just have like two cops there, you know, like they could have had two of them standing right there and like maybe if like 40 protesters had come and tried to like distract them and spray paint them, like sure, but like having two or three cops there for a week or two probably costs the same as having 60 cops getting overtime for a full like 18 hour overnight special statue guard. It's just like insane.
The pictures look good though. Look at our boys in blue out there defending our national history.
Sorry, I shouldn't use that word. They look ridiculous and silly is what they look like. Anyway, it's fine.
They didn't look as silly as those civilians who took it upon themselves to go and guard the statues like on their own time.
Yeah,
which is also very funny. Nation
very
of cops,
patriotism.
Nation of tiny little cop babies. Anyway, now it's time for
Shitpost of the Week.
So this week we have a Shitpost of the Week and a Shitpost of the Week of our heart. And both of them have like a shout out attached. So I'm going to shout out to Kira Janali for sharing this original post, which was from someone named Gaius Edy, not sure I'm saying that right, who appears to be a white Lithuanian man who
a Facebook artist.
Yeah, he painted this painting, which is technically gorgeous. It's like this beautiful, I think it's oil painting. It looks really good. And it's of this black guy wearing a like COVID mask and with big dreads hugging a cup. And Kira shared it into the group with some remark like, who wants to dunk on this guy? And everyone dunked on him. And it was great. But the shitpost of the week is going to a member of Ozpol shitposting, Patrick Durney, for an image comment remix of this painting, where he's just, or Patrick says, this took me like 5 minutes to finish for them. And it's the same painting, except the black guy is putting a sign that says, kick me, on the cop's back. And it's just a beautiful, like...
It's really well done. It's
really well done.
Photoshop. Yeah. No one can roast a Facebook artist better than another Facebook artist.
It's true. And it just, like, it subverts the whole original image so beautifully. It's just like, yeah, this is what should have been happening in that image.
It's excellent memeing. I'd also like to point out that that's very obviously a watercolor noon, but anyway.
I don't know shit about paintings. That's fine. there's no symbolism in here. I only like paintings with symbols. All right. So that's the shitpost of the week.
Pure subtext.
Shitpost of the week of our heart. We also have a shout out to Mina, who is our new mod in Ozpol shitposting. And she shared, welcome. And this is a good post that they made. She shared a top secret Antifa bunker schematic revealed meme, which is like this diagram of a bunker with all of the like secret Antifa training labs and like Soros. Whatever. But the shitpost of the week of our heart goes to multiple shitpost of the week winner, Chris Ritchie, for doing an Ozpol shitposting remix. Zach, do you maybe want to take us through the remix?
Sure. So, I mean, the only level that's visible to the outside world that's above ground just looks like an abandoned building. But if you go below the surface, there's so many rooms where all sorts of ACAB Antifa stuff is happening. So Chris has labeled the entrance up here. We've got the answer the questions entrance.
Accurate.
And one level down, we've got the shitpost requisition center and the shitpost research and development division.
Mm-hmm,
below
mm-hmm.
that, we've got the ACAB spice and vegetable patch, where we grow all of our little spices that we like to sprinkle on memes. We've also, below that, got the MacGyver weapons and discourse workshop. We've got the feel the burn sad posting alcohol therapy zone, which is one of my favorite zones. Below that,
zone.
We've got the Soros funded horny / lonely edition quarters. Lots
which
of
is a reference because just this week we've opened a new Ozpol shitposting horny / lonely dating group attached to the main group. So that's
a really excellent
about.
name yeah. for a dating
horny
group.
Horny / lonely edition. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, really. I can't go in there because I'm neither, but it sounds great. And then on the bottom floor, we've got the Thomas Zachary Memorial Juicer Super Soldier Lab, which if you don't know...
That is the very bottom level of Ozpol shitposting, is our Thomas Zachary Memorial Juicer Super Soldier Lab.
I'm not going to try to explain it to you. If you know,
listeners,
you know.
That's, yeah, yeah. So, very good memes. Thank you both. And,
excellent memeing.
And shout-outs to Kieran and Amina for those share layup someones. Yeah.
Yeah, it's always the best when it's like somebody bringing something into the group and then other people
being like,
are
we need some content
riffing
about
on
this.
It.
And then people, yeah.
So it's not, I always love it when the shitposting community comes together.
All right. Now our next segment.
Yeah, so this is kind of going to be like a long mains-ish kind of thing. But we'll start with the You Fucked Up.
You Fucked Up.
So who else could it be this week? I mean, there's been one main character in Australian politics this week, and that is, of course, Adam Somurek, who has just been sacked from the Victorian Labor Ministry and completely booted from the Labor Party. So this is over.
He's still an MP, by the way. So he Labor Party can't kick him out of Parliament for this stuff that he's done. But yeah, so he's an independent now, basically.
Yes. A very, very naughty independent. So he was kicked out over branch stacking allegations that were revealed in a joint investigation by 60 Minutes and The Age, or if you prefer to think of it as one single investigation by Channel 9. So he's a member of the Victorian Legislative Council, which is the upper house, and I had to look that up. I have to look that up every time, whether it's the Legislative
Council
or Assembly.
Or council. Yeah, yeah.
Why do we have different names? It's so unnecessarily confusing.
Yep.
But he's a member of the Victorian Legislative Council, the upper house, he represents the southeastern metropolitan region, which is one of 8 electoral regions in Victoria, which basically consists of the north, the east, the west of Victoria, and then 5 tiny little metro regions.
In Melbourne.
And if that seems unnecessarily specific, I'll come back to it later.
Mm-hmm.
But he was the Minister for Small Business and for Local Government. So if you do not know what branch stacking is, let's do a quick rundown. So basically, sure. Within a political party, within Labor, it's got several local branches, and those branches have the ability to choose which member of the Labor Party they want to represent them in that area.
This is like a pre-selection, right? So they're trying to decide who's going to stand as the Labor candidate for whatever seat that they're in, or that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the theory being that you, like, put up someone from your local area who knows the region and is part of the community and stuff, although in practice, obviously, that doesn't happen.
Who has the support of the rest of the party, and
Et cetera, so what branch stacking is basically when you fake support for your candidate within a branch by doing one of a number of dodgy things. The most common thing that most common way to do it is to sign up people to your political party who don't give a fuck about politics at all, couldn't care less, who just put their name on a piece of paper and sign it because you're like, hey, just sign this and
it'll be great.
You can forget about it. Yeah. Yeah. You don't have to do anything else. Or, you know, maybe you bribe them or incentivize them to sign up one way or the other. So the way that political parties try to avoid this is they'll have like a small sign-up fee for members so that people can't just like put their name on a piece of paper and then be like, yeah, yeah, sure, I vote for whatever candidate you've chosen. In the case of the Labor Party, it's $50 if you want to sign up for a year. A year's membership is $50. So what Somurek was doing is basically going around and signing up a whole bunch of people and getting some of his employees to sign up a whole bunch of people who couldn't give less of a fuck about politics and then paying the fees on their behalf. So extra dodgy stuff. They were like, because it meant that he had to go around and take out like massive amounts of cash from ATMs.
One of the things that he got in trouble for was a video of him pulling out $2,000 of an ATM and giving it to someone and being like, now make sure you commit those crimes, buddy. Or like, it's not quite that overt, but it's like nearly that.
No, it's almost exactly
almost,
like,
yeah, yeah.
He's walking around with fat stacks of cash in envelopes, delivering them to people in car parks. Like, it doesn't get much shadier than that.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
The other way to branch stack is just to have completely fake members. Which you can do in a branch that you completely control. So you have, you know, you're the person who is
doing the administrative double checking.
Exactly.
Or yeah.
There's no one looking over your shoulder and checking this stuff. So you sign up a whole bunch of fake names with fake addresses. And then once they've, one of the techniques that Somriak was using is called warehousing, which is basically you have these fake members with fake addresses and you bring them in through your branch. And then once they are regarded as legitimate members by the party database, then you can move them around to other branches and it's not nearly as obvious that they're fake because yep. They look like they've come from somewhere else and no one is like, hey, there's no person attached to this name or address. But so that was what he was up to, basically stacking branches in order to get members of the right-wing faction of the Labor Party installed in positions of power throughout the Victorian branch. So I don't know if we need to go into factionalism that much, but suffice it to say there are formalized factions within the Labor Party. There's left and right, and they're constantly at war with one another. And that is where a whole bunch of the political skullduggery comes from when it comes to Labor, is the conflict between those factions. So Somurek basically did this really, really effectively for a number of years and accumulated a huge amount of power for himself, because obviously he then basically got himself the ability to promise people that they would get pre-selected for a certain seat, which is a big thing to be able to promise someone. And you know, that is how politics works. You offer somebody something in exchange for a favor. You gather allies around yourself or people who are too afraid to cross you. And then suddenly you're a very powerful member of the party, even though you have basically no public profile and definitely no persona or charisma to speak of at all.
Yeah.
In the case of Somurek, if you've ever seen the guy speak in public, he's just an absolute wet dishcloth of a person. Absolutely, like, he's got nothing to contribute. But so I just wanted to read this one quote from the Age article, which I think just briefly sort of sums up the dodgy shit that he was getting up to. So, and they reference here a number of recordings that they've accessed in which Somurek just like flagrantly incriminates himself and talks as if he's Malcolm Tucker from In the Thick of It. Real, you know, it's just really funny. Like those recordings, they're really horrible.
They
reveal this guy who's just absolutely fucking drunk on power. He's so greedy and so arrogant. And this quote from The Age, I think, sums it up. It says, the recordings reveal Somurek ordering others to forge signatures and create dozens of false statements in which Labor branch members claim to have paid for their memberships when Somurek or his political operatives have footed the bill. He also talks about directing taxpayer-funded parliamentary employees who themselves claim to have the backing of their bosses to conduct party political operations. Somurek's misconduct appears to breach ALP rules designed to stop branch stacking and may also breach the law. So contained in there is this other bit of dodginess separate to the branch stacking involved with the branch stacking, but it's a separate thing, which is that you're not supposed to use taxpayer-funded parliamentary employees to do party political business.
And this happens, there's like debate about this every election when it comes around, because it's like, well, what else are these staffers supposed to do if not campaign on behalf of their employee? But like, because they're not allowed to be doing parliament shit in that time either, but like...
Yeah.
Anyway, that's sort of beside the point.
There was the red shirt scandal a couple of
years
ago.
Yeah, of course.
Which was also Victorian Labour. Yeah, but basically they were using taxpayer-funded employees to go and do like campaigning for them and that kind of thing. So this is not new to the Labour Party. And you'll notice that branch stacking is a term that already exists. This isn't some kind of new form of corruption that Somurek has invented. Like, it's just an accepted part of doing business, and, like, it's something Sorry, go on.
Something that I think is very telling about that is that all of the reporting, and when you hear the interviews of the, like, very few ALP people who are willing to front the media this week, they're saying things like, oh, yes, well, this is industrial branch stacking, or, like, no one had any idea of the scale at which this was going on, or, like, that sort of thing. But, like...
Yeah.
But they're like, oh, yeah... Everyone does
branch stacking. Like, I mean, that's just politics.
That's how we do things. Yeah,
yeah. And it doesn't just happen within political parties as well.
No. And like, I think also parties, like, quite aside from the branch stacking, like that's kind of a symptom of how they operate, right? Like, there's this whole issue about numbers people, right? Numbers men or whatever that people like Somurek and like Anthony Albanese or whatever who spent their entire careers counting people to make sure that they have a 50% plus one majority to get whatever they want up. And whether that's like policy at the ALP conference or if it's about getting pre-selections done or getting people elected as like party president or party secretary or whatever, like all of these internal positions, that like the way that that all happens is by winning votes. And so to become a powerful politician, you have to know how to win votes. And the like... official way to do that is by counting and calling people and arguing with them and getting them to be on side or whatever. But it's apparently much, much easier to just invent a bunch of fake people and be like, oh yeah, they're voting for me, so I win. Right? The branch stacking is a symptom of the party's setup, not...
Absolutely. No, and that's, you know, this is... It's a symptom of a much broader culture and not just at the... Victorian Labour Party, but nationally, and not just the Labour Party, but all political parties, but especially the majors.
Yeah.
This kind of stuff where, you know, you've got this guy, nowhere in any of this at any point is anything ever mentioned about what his values might be, what he believes in, what he wants
he
to achieve
to
in politics.
But
he's
even
definitely
that
homophobic.
Seem like a priority. It's just
but
like,
no, it's not a that's not even like. That's not a policy position.
No,
he's just a
he's
piece
just a
of
jerk.
Shit.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That, and but that's it. That like the it is purely politics. It's purely about power. And if you listen to the recordings, which as you mentioned, Noon, and you know, he says a number of homophobic and misogynist things, and he said misogynist things specifically about the Minister for Women, Gabrielle Williams, which is obviously a fucking great look. You know, most progressive government in Australia.
Yeah.
But you know, like he's saying things like, "Oh, fuck the premier. Premier's a cunt. I'm the one who's going to decide who's premier."
Yeah.
Like. That's what matters to these people. And he's not an isolated case. And in fact, two of his closest allies have resigned from the ministry as a result of this. Robin Scott, who's the assistant treasurer, and Marlene Kairouz, who's a consumer affairs minister. And those are both names you can instantly forget, because why would you care who they are? Why would you ever need to know who they are again? The only time you ever learn the name of a fucking state politician is when they do some shit like this.
Something embarrassing and awful, yeah.
Yeah. And the other sort of major bit of fallout from this is that Andrews has asked the Labour National Executive to run all of the state and federal pre-selections for the next 3 years and suspend the voting rights of every member. So, branch
which is fine, because they've only actually got like 18 members. So those 18 people will be pissed off, but then the other like 3,600 fake names won't be a problem.
Well, the people that they have pissed off are the Plumbers Union and the CFMMEU.
Yeah.
CFMMEU.
Thanks.
Who are both the CFMEU saying that they might consider legal action against the Labour Party for withdrawing their voting rights. So there's drama incoming about this. And, you know, it's far from over. And there have been rumblings that you were telling me, Noon, of people saying that Andrews might not contest the next Victorian election.
Yeah, this was sort of a rumor on a radio show, so like not confirmed, but a liberal dude was like, "Oh yeah, yeah, everyone knows Andrew's going to step down before the next election," which happens, you know, like that's a normal thing to happen. But like, I was a bit surprised because Andrews seems to be like having a good time and doing well. But
well,
yeah,
was.
I was like, that's probably just speculation. But then the Labour hack who was on the same panel was like, well. And change the subject completely. So I can only assume that means that, yes, she does know that he's about to leave and didn't want to say anything about it, by the way. So,
well, I guess we'll find out soon. I mean, we are due to have our state election this year.
Yep.
But so, I didn't actually really want to talk about any of that because,
no.
You know, it's like...
It's boring bullshit.
Well, that's it. It's just, you know, at the end of the day, it's being treated as this big, like... expose, and it is when, you know, like the recordings and the photographs of him picking up, you know, envelopes full of cash and that kind of thing. Yeah, very sensational. But at the end of the day, as we were discussing, it's fucking business as usual within
major everyone knew
parties.
This was happening. Everyone in the party, everyone in the opposition, every journalist.
For sure. And that knowing that he's not the only person doing this by a long shot.
Yeah.
But everybody agrees to look the other way because there's very little reward for sticking your neck out on something like this, and you don't cross a guy like Somyurek unless you know you're prepared to go nuclear.
Before we move on,
obviously someone did.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's actually what I wanted to mention is that a lot of people are speculating that these videos and stuff were orchestrated by a guy called Anthony Byrne, who's Labour's like spook guy who thinks he's a spy, and no one knows who he is because he's like shadowy figure, but he's just an MP. It seems like he's probably been doing all of this branch stacking bullshit and was like carefully involved, and that's why he was able to like plant cameras and get Somyurek to be like, yes, yes, let's commit some crimes on camera. And he tweeted out something cryptic just before this story broke that people think was him saying that he had arranged it. But it's funny to me because I reckon he probably doesn't give a fuck about people breaking the rules or whatever. He was like, oh, finally a chance to do some spy shit. I can do a sting and get this guy. And so he did. And it was his own little internal meta power trip. That's my read on the thing. But anyway, as you say, we don't need to talk about it.
No, I mean
more. Yeah.
That's all. It's just power plays and guys being like, how can I make myself feel important today?
Totally. Yeah.
Woo, politics. All right. So that wasn't even really the meat of the mains, and we're coming up to 50 minutes. So I'm just going to say it here now. We're going to blow massively over time.
Cool.
We're just going to do it. We're going to throw rest of our timetable and our notes out the window, and we're going to get stuck into some potentially really dry local government discussions.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
Woo! Yeah. This is one of those subjects for me that like teeters right on the edge when I'm researching for it. It teeters right on the edge of being like so super fascinating because it's so monumentally fucked, and then also being extremely boring because it's about the intricacies of electoral structure in local government.
Yeah.
But I think this is ultimately a much more interesting story than the branch stacking. And we're coming to this a little bit late. So this is what we're going to be discussing is the Local Government Act 2020, which is, it's still Victoria. It's still Adam Somurek. I know that this is becoming quite a parochial show where we discuss political life in Melbourne. But, you know, look, that's how it is.
It's what's been happening this week.
And it is also what's been happening, or in this case, is what happened about a year ago. But so, as I mentioned, Adam Somurek was the Minister for Local Government in Victoria, and he introduced this bill, the Local Government Bill 2020, about a year ago. And I remember it coming up at the time, looking at it and being like, damn, that seems like a complicated story. We should talk about it on the podcast, which we only started like a couple of weeks prior. And then I looked into it and I was like,
oh, that's too much.
I didn't understand this at all.
But now, a year later.
A year down the track, I had the good fortune of becoming friends with someone who was once very involved in local government and has been an amazing resource for this story. So I just want to shout out friend, confidant, and member of my inner sanctum, Jess, for all of his help and research on this. He even like emailed politicians on my behalf and let me know what they told him about this.
That's awesome.
So some of this shit is straight from the horse's mouth. But so you may have, as I pointed out earlier, Adam Somurek represents the southeastern metropolitan electoral area of Victoria. And that is kind of what we're going to be talking about, is electoral regions or wards specifically. So this Local Government Act 2020, which came into effect in May earlier this year, is going to have, it does a few different things, but its main function is going to be making most local councils in Victoria single member wards. And that's, you know, the electoral structure that they're going to have.
So just to clarify, a ward is like a seat, right? So in the lower house, we have seats and they're like an area and one person gets elected from that. And it's the same in councils, that they might have five wards and that the wards will have one person in them, right? So then there's five people on council.
Yeah, so a ward is really just the local government name for an electorate.
Yep.
It's no more complicated than that.
Yep.
And yeah, so you basically touched on what the difference between a single-member ward and a multi-member ward is, which are the two most common structures for councils across, for local governments across Australia. So a multi-member ward is when you'll have a whole bunch of people elected to represent a single area. And that's the way that we do things with the Legislative Council in Victoria, for example, or the Senate, the Federal Senate in Australia. States effectively operate as one large electorate who en masse elect a number of senators who then represent them as a whole.
Totally.
Whereas federal lower house MPs represent what is basically a single member ward system, where the states are broken up into individual little electorates who each represent who each elect one person to represent them.
Yep.
Does that make sense? Is that clear?
Yep. Like the name pretty much is exactly what it is: single member wards, multi member wards. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And so a multi member ward will represent a much larger physical area.
Sure.
Have more people. So, you know, you get the same amount, you'll end up with a similar amount of councillors. It's just the way, the method by which they are chosen and elected. Okay, so I'll get into a little bit more about what the results of multi and single member wards are a little bit later.
Sure.
But off the top, I'm just going to tell you what Adam Somurek gave as his justification for introducing these changes. He said that switching to single-member wards, which is the main effect of the Local Government Act 2020, will give greater accountability, equity, and grassroots democracy, and it will simplify the voting system. And he said that he thought that voters would be confused by a, quote, disparate mix of systems when it comes to electing people. But obviously, in Australia, we already have two systems, as I've just described, on a federal level. And, like, okay, maybe there's one more that people have to deal with at a local level, but they're only going to have to deal with the one that they live in.
And also, or, like, people fill out the forms that they get given when they're elected, you know? And, like, people are confused even if they're all exactly the same, you know? Like, it's a good...
Well, yeah, our electoral system is confusing, and you're not making it less confusing by, like, arbitrarily deciding to change a bunch of the electoral systems at one level. And, you know, so I was doing a bit of reading around this, and all these articles are basically from a year ago when the bill was first introduced. And there's just all these quotes from people being really confused about why it's happening. But this one here from the mayor of the Surf Coast Shire, who says, "I just don't know where the minister is coming up from on this one." The mayor of Darabin said, "Council finds it particularly difficult to understand the state's rationale in moving all councils to single-member ward structure. Darabin does not believe this leads to greater community representation." And this quote from an Age article from the time, which said, "Senior party insiders told the Sunday Age that they were genuinely surprised by the announcement. They insist it was not a response to party pressure."
Right, so it's not like a piece of policy that the Labour Party has developed. It was something Adam Somierek came up with, basically.
That's what seems to be happening, yes.
And also the things that he said it would do, it seems like the people in local council think it will not do that. That's what they're saying, right? Like, isn't going to increase diversity or whatever that he says.
Well,
it's gonna...
I mean, he says that it's got greater accountability, equity, and better grassroots democracy, which is basically like, if you represent a smaller area, then you are better able to represent the wishes of those people, is basically the theory. Uh-huh. So it's important to note that this move towards single-member wards is in direct opposition to the historical trend in Victoria. At the moment, 7 of 79 councils in Victoria have single-member wards, compared to 43 in 2003. So across the state, councils are moving away from single-member wards and towards multi-member wards.
Mm-hmm.
So why the fuck did Somierek do this? And I think there's some statistics that might help make it clear. This is some info that I've gotten from Twitter user at Zacchaeus E. I might post the link to this in the show notes because I think it's interesting. But they basically compiled all of the results from the 2016 local council elections into a massive spreadsheet, crunched the numbers. And what their results showed was that women are 8% more likely to be elected under ward structures that will be prohibited by the Local Government Act 2020. Uh-huh. In general, single-member wards are 9% less likely to elect female councillors than councils as a whole, and they're 11% less likely than councillors elected through proportional representation or multi-member wards. So basically, these changes make it much harder for women and people from minority groups to get elected to councils. It basically means that old white men are going to be elected to councils far more often. That's what this bill does. But also, it massively favors the major parties. So, less diverse all around, massively in favor of Labour.
And the reason for that is probably not really worth maybe you're going to get into it a bit later. Sorry, never mind. I shouldn't have interrupted. About proportional representation, that's fine. Just like what the difference is and why it leads to that, but that's right.
Yeah, no, I think it's an important part of the discussion. And we'll get into, why it all works. But basically, for the time being, just take it from me when I tell you that single-member wards, much less diverse results. That's how it works. So this bill was like opposed by all of the smaller parties and like independents in Victorian government. So the Greens and the Animal Justice Party and, I'm sure there's some other ones
as well. All the right-wing ones or whatever, yeah.
They're all just like, this is obviously fucked and this is just an attempt to make it much harder for us to get elected. And this coincided roughly with the Labour announcing that they were going to be returning in an official capacity to contesting local elections, which they haven't been doing for a while.
Right. So up until now, they've been like unofficially endorsing people. Is that right? They've been like people have been running as independents, heavy scare quotes, but with Labour funding and signage and money and
I think it's almost more like the other way around. Members of the Labour Party will run for local council, but they won't be officially endorsed by the Labour Party. They'll be understood to be like a Labour candidate, but they don't get like funding and official endorsement from the federal party. And it's like corruption at local council level that I think had made the major parties turn away from contesting local elections. But also there's just not a lot of glamour and power in it, like as a position. You're talking about potholes, it's a fucking cliche, but you're talking about potholes in like local parks and stuff a lot of the time.
And it's not like the US where the lowest levels of elected government directly affect the upper echelons, where they like, school boards can rearrange voting districts and shit. So that makes sense. It's not a priority for the big parties.
Yeah, so, you know, basically they didn't see it as worth their while. And but the line that they ran was like, oh, look, local government should be run by local people, and we're just, you know, we're going to keep partisanship out of it, which, you know, is just a load of shit when yep. either of the major parties says anything like that. But so they, you know, the major parties basically completely vacated local elections across the country, and in Melbourne, who stepped into that void was the Greens, and yep. they are now performing really strongly at a local council level. In fact, all over the country, but in Melbourne in particular, which, you know, was once sort of Labour heartland, and people higher up in the Labour Party started to look around and be like, hey, we're losing election after election. Nobody likes us. What's going on? We're losing all of our popular support. And one of the reasons that they've decided to put it down to is the fact that the Greens are kicking their ass at a local level. So Labour officially announces that they're going to get back into local elections. And lo and behold, Adam Somurek basically unilaterally, as far as I can tell, introduces this bill. It's going to make it much more likely for Labour Party candidates to get elected to local councils. So, as you mentioned before, Noon, it's probably good to talk about why multi-member wards give you more diverse results, why yeah. single-member wards favor old white men and candidates from the major parties. So this comes down to this concept that we were talking about before of proportional representation, which basically means that candidates are elected based on the proportion of votes they got, not just who got the most votes.
Mm-hmm. So in single-member wards, it's a first-past-the-post situation, right? You have to get 50% of the votes plus one votes, and then you win. Whereas with proportional representation, there's a percentage that if you pass that quota, you get a seat, right? So say there's like 10 seats being allocated, you have to get 10% plus one to get a seat. And then 10 people get seats, or whatever it is. Yeah, my maths is terrible, but you get the idea.
Yeah,
you need a much smaller total number of votes to get the seat.
Exactly, which makes it much easier for people from minority groups or diverse backgrounds to get elected. Because if you're just taking, like, the person who gets the most votes, then that is likely to be an older white man, just based on the demographics that are contained within Australian electorates most of the time.
But and we also, like, we see this play out every election in Australia because, as you mentioned, our lower house is first-past-the-post single-member seats, and the Senate is proportional representation and multi-member seats. And the Senate much more accurately reflects the
yeah,
beliefs and demographics of the Australian population. Like, it's still skewed towards, like, a white male, whatever, but, like, it's much closer, and, like, the views that are put forward are much closer to Australia's general makeup. And that's why the Senate keeps being obstructionist for the last decade, because it's, like, actually, the country doesn't agree on things, and the Senate reflects that a lot of the time.
Totally. Much more diverse. But so proportional representation is much more likely to return diverse results, but single-member wards stifle electoral competition as well because it's much easier to make a single-member ward a safe seat, basically.
That makes sense.
Yes. So one example of this that came up a bunch when I was doing research about this was Botany Bay Council in Sydney, whose mayor and all six other councillors were all Labour, and they were all elected unopposed. This was in the early 2000s. And by 2012, six out of seven of the councillors there had first been elected 15 or more years previously,
The
mayor having had a record term in office of 31 years.
Wow.
That's what single-member wards gets you.
Yep.
You just get this rusted on people and people don't even run to oppose them because it's so politically hopeless.
It's pointless, yeah.
Because they get such a vice grip over the seat. But if it's a multi-member ward and more seats are up for competition, more often than not, some of those seats will be in play. Maybe one or two of them will be safe. Maybe the major parties have more resources to pour into getting their mayor re-elected. But you're much more likely to be able to get people who have different perspectives up on that council, which obviously results in more equitable representation for the people, much more democratic. So that's why this Local Government Act 2020, introduced by Adam Semeryuk, and its conversion of councils to single-member wards is fucked. But also the act did a whole bunch of other stuff, giving the Minister for Local Government a whole bunch more power.
Right. Of course it did.
Yeah, so, you know, people probably know what gerrymandering is, and it's something that doesn't really happen here very much because of the way that our systems are set up. We've got much better safeguards for
independent organizations,
electoral commissions here in Australia than we do in the States, where gerrymandering is really common. But what this bill does was make it much easier for the minister to gerrymander if they really wanted to. So the act basically made the decision about what a ward's boundaries would be up to the minister. So the minister may commission the Victorian Electoral Commission to conduct a review of the boundaries if there's a certain amount of variation in the amount of people enrolled in a ward. And then the minister may adopt the recommendations, the assumption being that the minister will accept the recommendations every time, but there's no obligation to. They could theoretically just suggest and adopt their own if they wanted. But the major power that the act gives the local government minister is that the local government minister basically can choose the electoral structure of wards. So the act makes single member wards the default.
Right.
But they could theoretically also be, you know, function as one big unsubdivided district, or it could have multi-member wards for, you know, can choose these for councils. But that choice can only be made regarding councils who have been put in a class of councils that the minister has previously determined is able to have that structure applied to it. So basically the minister draws up a list and is like, all of these councils here can only ever be single-member wards.
Single-member.
And this list here could, you know, that I can change them later when I feel like it. And that decision is made by the minister and the minister alone. So that's a purely political decision made by a partisan person who has like unchecked power over this, basically. So
yeah, this section. Sorry, this may be a bit of a long bow to draw, but it reminds me of the whole thing with Juukan Caves, right? That the West Australian mining minister, that there's a law that says that they couldn't blow up those caves unless the minister says that it's fine. And the minister said that it was fine. And, like, there's so many of these things. And, like, it's the same in refugee policy, right? With, like, the minister can decide to just let people to be, like, not in prison anymore, like, refugee concentration camps anymore. But they don't, right? And, like, every single time there's a ministerial discretion option in any kind of fucking field of government, every single time it's only ever used for selfish political gain and never for, like, independent decision-making. Because that's what a minister is a political animal, not an independent decision-maker. Anyway,
of course.
Yep.
Naturalement. So I mean, that sort of that gives an overview of why this act is fucked. And yes, we're a little bit late to the party because it's already in effect, and it, you know, we can't like petition people about changing it at this, or, you know, not nearly as effectively as we could have. But obviously, there were campaigns about this at the time. But
local council not the sexiest social justice issue.
It just really isn't, and you know, obviously, it's very locally specific as well, which makes it kind of harder to get some sort of critical mass on. But I thought it was an interesting story to tell about Semeryuk, because the branch stacking stuff is shithouse, but it's internal. And this
is possibly
a much
even
more
not illegal, which is wild. It's like, and the Labour Party got him in trouble, and he is being investigated by police, but like, it's not clear that he broke any laws.
No. But these changes to the Local Government Act are much, I think, more long-term and severe undermining of general democratic processes. And it's a real lesson, I think, that, like, political parties know, as we discussed, that they have these absolutely ruthless, purely political operators running around in their party doing all this wild stuff and being extremely dodgy and obviously out to get as much power as they possibly can for themselves without, you know, not representing a value or any kind of political position at all, purely just about power. And they look the other way because they're like, that's how business is done. But those people are fucking dangerous because if you put them in a position where they can start to affect things outside of the party and not just try to accumulate power for themselves internally but also start to try and rig the system in their favor, that shit is really dangerous and has really, really nasty long-term effects. And that's what we're seeing in the States at the moment in terms of the composition of the Supreme Court and the fact that like,
and the those red map. Are...
Exactly, and with the gerrymandering there. So I think the States is a... They're a cautionary tale about what happens when you allow elected people to start to make decisions about what the system looks like. And it'll happen here if these people are allowed to continue to operate unchecked. You have a responsibility as a political party to come down these people and be like, no, you can't run around doing this wild shit. Like, you need to take a stand at some point. You can't just look the other way because they're on your team.
Yeah, so, for real.
I've, like...
And, you know, shout out Anthony Byrne, presumably, for fucking up Adam Somurek, I guess. But, like, there's a 0% chance that he isn't also doing this shit. And, like...
1,000,000%.
Yeah, yeah.
So, just to round out this segment, I have just a few little things here that didn't quite fit into the main narrative of the story, but essentially this shit was just so hypocritical on a number of levels. And Noon and I forgot to prepare a positivity corner this week. So I thought maybe instead we could do hypocrisy corner.
Cool.
So you just want to help me re-record this thing a little
bit? Yeah, sure.
So we'll do two parts each. And then I'll layer them all together, and it'll be horrific.
Are we going to do it at the same time, or?
Let's do it one by one, and then I'll layer them up later.
Hypocrisy corner.
That should do it.
See how that goes. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So hypocrisy corner. Okay, Adam Somurek is elected to the Legislative Council in Victoria, which is a fucking multi-member ward system. He was elected under a multi-member ward system.
Yep.
Also. He fired the dysfunctional Geelong Council in 2016. In order to fix it, they made it a multi-member ward.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck? Also, Labor's manifesto, their policy platform going into the 2016 election, was to, quote, support diverse representation. Interesting. And the last thing I kind of wanted to mention here was... I was discussing this story with my partner, Holly, the other night, and she was like, what are you going to talk about on the podcast? And I was like, oh, I'm thinking about talking about this local government stuff. It's pretty cooked. I told her the story, and she was like, so are they going to change it? Like, are they going to go back and change the act, like this clear power grab instigated by this guy that is now publicly known as a pure power grabber? And so I thought I might just read you a quote from Daniel Andrews from the other day. He said, when he was asked whether or not they were going to review any of the policy that Adam Somurek had put forward in his tenure in the ministry, he said, quote, the minister has taken forward positions endorsed by cabinet. He has made a number of different positions pursuant to his role as minister. I am not aware of any reason to go back over those or to be concerned about those.
Really? No reason to be concerned?
No.
Like, okay. All right, I guess it's fine.
Cool. So that is a tale of how political parties are bad and we shouldn't have them anymore.
I like it. Thanks, Zach. That was a very informative and upsetting story. Thank you for
hopefully it made sense. I normally make much more rigorous notes for this kind of thing, but I tried kind of deliberately making them a little bit looser so that it would feel a little bit more natural when I said it. But obviously one of the other side effects of that is that it was probably a bit meandering and doubling back and that kind of thing. But anyway, I hope it all made sense. And I'm sure that there was stuff in there that was wrong. And if you, for example, my friend Jess or another person who knows about this and there are details that you think were missing or incorrect, please get at us. You
can send please. Us a we love a getting potluck. Fact checked and corrected.
Yeah, fact check us. Any one of a number of ways, including on various social media platforms, but also by recording a minute of audio of yourself and sending it to ozpolsnackpod@gmail.com, or it could be a bit of audio about some other political thing that you want to rant about, and we'll play it on the show. But cool, that probably does it for the show itself. We just wanted to shout out a couple of things. We got a new review on Apple Podcasts from Jace, who gave us 5 stars and said, "I love the boys," which is...
Oh, thanks, Jace.
Extremely sweet. Thank you, Jace.
And we also have a new patron, Sean. So thank you so much, Sean, for signing up. When you sign up to our Patreon for $1 a month or more, you get access to a monthly bonus episode. This month's one is going to be on QAnon. You also get to, for $5 or more, you get to ask us questions for our bonus episode and suggest topics and stuff. So this was one that we got asked to do about QAnon. I've been neck deep in the QAnon theories. So yeah, that'll be coming out hopefully next week. And should be some good stuff. And you also get other cool stuff, and you can join our Discord and blah, 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 blah. So yeah, hop on patreon.com/OzPaulSnackPod. Give us a buck. And we always value reviews on Apple iTunes or anywhere else. So yeah, if you haven't left us a review, we'd really love that. Otherwise, I think that's probably us for the week. We have gone wildly over time, but we warned you earlier about it, so that's fine. We're going to try not to make this our new regular extra long. Soon we'll be doing 4-hour podcasts. Oh,
there's only, I've only got so much life in me.
I feel you.
You know what I mean? All right, well, this is where the sign-off would normally go.
Yeah, fuck cops, crunch, crunch.